Remark that this text may well contain text mistakes not corrected. All those audio files on this server is made for personal use, but also shared with others, who similarly seek deeper meanings of life and the spiritual. Title, Darkness Over Tibet. By the author of, In Secret Tibet, Theodore Alien. First published in 1938. The publisher gives free permission for reprinting of material from this book. Introduction. The German traveler Theodore Alien was one of the first travelers to penetrate Tibet while it was still sealed off from the outside. Alien, who spoke fluent Tibetan, had to disguise himself as a wandering Tibetan monk in order to escape detection, as it was illegal for any foreigner to be in Tibet. He began planning his trip in 1932 and left Germany in 1934. After several years of adventures and hair-raising narrow escapes with death, he returned to Germany to write Radfellhaft's Tibet, published in Hamburg in 1936. His books were quickly translated into English and published by Ryder & Company in London, In Secret Tibet, 1937, and Darkness Over Tibet, 1938. Darkness Over Tibet is an extremely rare book. Alien made some chance acquaintances which led to contacts with wise men and black magicians. He then was invited to live and study in an underground city in central Tibet. His subsequent escape and hair-raising journeys are classic travel writing of the 1930s. It is believed that Alien's accounts of Tibet were instrumental in persuading the Nazi government of Germany to send yearly expeditions into Tibet. The first volume, In Secret Tibet, recounts the first episodes of Alien's fascinating adventures in Central Asia. Preface. In my book In Secret Tibet, I have given an outline of my recent journey to Tibet, showing how, passing through successive contacts with the Tibetan multitude and gangs of brigands, I finally succeeded in visiting Tibetan monasteries in the disguise of a native. After witnessing various marvels, such as the flying lamas and the Tibetan rispas, I reached the final stage of the journey in the most inaccessible part of the country where live the genuine Tibetan hermits, who can read people's thoughts and possess the strange power to maintain themselves young almost indefinitely. My talks with these wise men, which are recorded in my earlier book, reflect a certain degree of understanding of the vital problems of life and death, spiritual crimes, salvation and eternity, and many of my readers will have wondered how the author arrived at a degree of understanding which made these spiritual contacts possible. Let me say, then, in this connection, that real understanding in spiritual matters is the result of much bitter fighting, of suffering, spiritual agony and soul passion. Life itself would have no meaning if there was no fighting on all planes, if all was smooth and monotonous. Everything fights in nature. Every plant fights to get more sunshine. People who can sit naked and motionless for several hours during icily cold nights without freezing to death. Every animal fights for food. The angels themselves fight. Constant struggle on all planes to which it has access is the birthright of the creature. Woe to him who wants to put himself on a level with the Creator and escape fighting. I had bitter experiences too. On my travels I have met some of the highest spiritual entities incarnated in the flesh, and not only those working for the Creator but also those working against him. Even the fires of hell have their mission. They destroy man if he is weak, but if he is strong they purify by burning the dross away. This book supplements In Secret Tibet by showing a different side of the picture, a few demons of light and many demons of the shadow. It will help the reader to realize that spirituality actually is a very stormy ocean. The currents of life are interwoven, and good and evil, light and shadow, are within a hair breadth from each other. The existence of an underground city in Tibet is occasionally hinted at by well-informed people in the Forbidden Country, although the stories are often extravagant and turn the underground city, which I succeeded in entering, into a mighty underground empire inhabited by millions of people. Tibet becomes somewhat more accessible as the years roll by, and I am confident that eventually other explorers will confirm my description of the underground city of Tibet. Chapter 1. Hunted by Tibetan Brigands. Keshikaru, the Tibetan brigand boy who ran away from his gang to join me in the lone solitudes of mysterious Tibet and who probably met a horrible death as a result of this independent attitude, was a bright young Tibetan whose brother, a stately robber, had induced the boy to join his own gang of bandits preying on unprotected travelers in western Tibet. The boy was grossly uneducated in the western sense of the word, but nevertheless was very clever. My talks with this youthful Tibetan brigand, he was hardly 17 years old when we traveled together, stand out as one of my bright and painful experiences in Tibet. His remarks on Western countries, although made in a humorously naive and childlike manner, were almost a revelation to me in many respects. In judging Western civilization, Xukaru, who had never heard anything about the West before, had the priceless advantage of viewing things in an absolutely unprejudiced manner, like someone from another planet. When listening to him, I felt like a person who has never left his own house, and therefore does not really know what it is like until he steps out of it and has a good look at it from outside. Xukaru was a member of the gang of robbers who attacked me in the early morning in a swampy district and with whom I had the amusing adventure recorded in my earlier book. One of the bandits had made a shortcut across the swamp in order to be the first to rob me. He had left his comrades a long way behind him. When the swamp swallowed him up to his chest, I saved his life and thus made friends with the whole gang. While we were having breakfast together and talking about travels and other countries, an exceptionally young member of the gang, I noted, a boy of about 16 or 17, was watching me continually with brilliant eyes. "How nice it must be not to be afraid," I heard him say admiringly to another brigand. After this remark, the boy snowed me his tongue again and again, which is a mark of high esteem in Tibet. A quarter of an hour later, the brigands wished me a slow journey. When they all smiled and showed me their tongues in parting, only the boy seemed to turn away. I walked away in a southerly direction. The bandits moved northward. When I turned round, I saw that he appeared to be lagging behind. The Tibetans use the term slow journey when really wishing a safe or happy journey, the very word slow having an auspicious meaning in the eyes of the Tibetans. The term fast has a rather unpleasant significance in Tibet. It is often associated with speed, cunning, and violence. The brigands shouted his name twice and the boy followed them, to all appearance rather reluctantly. For many hours I kept up a brisk pace. It was not until the wind began to blow in the afternoon that I sat down to take a good rest, having walked about 20 miles since I had parted company with the robbers. I felt a little tired and sleepy. It was the fourth week spent at an altitude of 15,000 feet while living on inadequate food and walking daily enormous distances in the thin mountain air. The wind had just begun to whirl up little clouds of fine sand which somewhat obscured the vision in the mildly undulating landscape bordered by high mountains in the distance, when a tiny little black spot appeared amidst the whirling sand. At first I thought it was an animal, but after a few minutes the moving figure grew larger and I saw that it walked upright. It was a human being, walking straight towards the place where I was seated. The chances of meeting another human being in the uninhabited expanses of northern Tibet are not greater than the prospect of winning a good-sized prize in a lottery. I could hardly believe my eyes. When the solitary wanderer was within a distance of a few yards, he stopped and stared at me spellbound. I recognized him. It was the Tibetan brigand boy who had watched me earlier in the day. "Oh Jayag, oh Jayag," said Ksu Karu. Polite greeting used in northern Tibet. It was my turn to be greatly astonished at meeting, making an effort. "It really means, you are the youngster whom I had seen moving in the opposite direction half a day before." In all probability, this boy had been forced to take up the robber's profession against his wish. He had seen a man traveling about quite alone in the desert who had not been afraid of a gang of robbers. This may have appealed strongly to the innate thirst of adventure and horror of mediocrity which are so common in boys of his age. For boys seem to be the same all over the world. Most of them are full of enthusiasm until they lose their high spirits by the bad example set by other people and the hard necessities of life. In fighting the depressing influence of their surroundings for years and years, most people succeed only outwardly. Their better selves are gradually twisted round and crippled in the struggle which boys of that age still have to face. After leaving his comrades, the Tibetan boy, as he told me later, had felt lonely and therefore decided to join me by following my footprints as fast as he could. Ksu Karu looked at me inquiringly. I was in deep thought, weighing the situation. Like most other things in life, the sudden appearance of the young Tibetan seemed to be a very mixed blessing. If the boy was not as tough as wire, he would be a dreadful hindrance by his inability to stand the physical strain of my rapid movements. Furthermore, sooner or later he would find out that I was a white person. On the other hand, the boy could be of some use if he was reliable and could stand the strain of heavy marches while living on small amounts of uncooked food. I could make him talk to the people and hold myself entirely in the background, thus further diminishing the chances of detection. Ksu Karu was strong and well built. His clothes were in good shape. He had brought along sufficient food for several days as well as a small bag filled with dry dung. He wore high leather shoes of excellent quality. The gang had obviously picked out the very cream of the belongings of their victims for personal use. He was fairly clean, and the expression of his eyes and features denoted exceptional energy and intelligence. I decided to take a chance with him. In any case, it was impossible to chase him out into the desert. The boy got ready to cook a meal. He opened the bag containing dried dung and his cooking utensils for making tea. He was greatly surprised and almost annoyed when I forbade him to kindle a fire, adding that as long as he traveled in my company I should never allow him to do so, neither for warming himself nor for cooking. After some reflection, Ksu Karu seemed to guess the reason of this precaution, which greatly increases the safety of unprotected travelers, and with an energetic movement he threw away his bag filled with dung. It was very strange to have a companion after so many weeks of solitary traveling. The brigand boy unpacked his belongings. Everything was almost new and fairly clean. The choice of the various items indicated much good taste and a practical and matter-of-fact attitude of the owner. I thought that if I took the boy along to the West after completing my journey in Tibet, he would adapt himself to Western conditions much faster than any other Tibetan I had met so far. Early in the morning he began to take off his clothes in order to wash in the Tibetan manner by rubbing his body with a good-sized pat of butter. He then came to me with another piece of butter and was greatly surprised when he saw that I refused to Washington. He probably thought I was a very unclean person. While Ksu Karu mused about the strange ways of his newly found companion, I thought of the best possible method of telling the boy that I was a white person. Unless I told him myself, he would sooner or later find it out himself. The withholding of such a secret from a clever companion sharing every moment of one's existence in the uninhabited wastes of Central Asia required much ingenuity and great discomfort, including the necessity of my abstaining from washing. After having partaken of an uncooked meal, when we were on our way again, I told the boy that I was half a day late and contemplated walking all day from morning till night. He did not seem to mind this. We did a good deal of talking. "Why are you not afraid?" asked the boy. "I watched you there on the dry island in the swamp. When your enemy approached threateningly, you stood there, quietly watching him. One does not make things better by being afraid, Shikaru," I replied. "We must take things in life as they come. It is stupid to defy dangers. But when dangers do come our way, we should face them coolly." "I greatly admired you there," said the boy, "but when the bandit was dragged down by the swamp and you threw the rope out to save his life, I was greatly surprised." "I saved him," I answered, assuming that he had a soul. "What is that?" "The thing that is best in us. Our real self. People who have a soul react to kindness. If you save an aggressor's life and he happens to have a soul, he is disarmed. His soul will prevent him from attacking his rescuer. Will all people feel disarmed by boundless kindness and love?" "No, Shikaru," I answered sadly, "not everybody. Only people who have a soul. But many people have a soul." "Tell me," said the Tibetan brigand, "suppose the man whose life you saved by pulling him out of the swamp had attacked you immediately afterwards. What would you have done then?" "I should have seen that he had no soul and should have pushed him back into the murderous swamp immediately." "Do you think that I have a soul?" asked the boy. I looked into his eyes. "Yes, Shikaru," I answered, "you have." "Can man lose his soul?" "Yes, I think so, but not all at once. It is a slow and dreadful process." "How can he lose it?" "By sinning against his soul."
"How?"
"By brutalizing his soul, by using God for selfish purposes."
"What is God?"
Dear me, now I had landed in a theological discussion with a Tibetan brigand. My knowledge of colloquial Tibetan was no longer up to the occasion. Anyhow, I had to go on with it.
"God is the one who made you," I said.
"Kobayas Parmayan," remarked Shikaru. "My father made me."
"Kyodilas Bayas Payin," I said, "but God made your soul. He is the father of your soul."
"Also of yours?"
"Yes, also of mine."
"So we are brothers?"
"Yes, we are.
The same father made our souls."
His eyes sparkled.
"I am glad you are my brother." After a slight pause he asked, "And the people who have no soul, who is their father?"
"They were children of our father," I answered sadly, "but the great black god Jay possesses their souls."
"Has he taken it?"
"Yes, or rather, they had given it to him.
He did not make me."
"Lbagfegt Benpo.
He made your body.
Could Lanag Chenpo take our souls too?"
"No, he cannot, unless we give them to him voluntarily.
But tell me who has more power, the father who made our souls, or the great black god?"
"Our father," I replied, "is more powerful.
Why does he not crush the great black god?"
"The great black god hates the father," I said, "but in his blind anger he really guards the father's house. If someone wants to be like the father, if a creature wants to be like the creator, the great black god seizes his soul."
"I no longer understand this," said the young brigand. I changed the topic. Drops of perspiration were standing on my forehead. So great had been the effort to discuss such problems in broken Tibetan. I walked faster and faster. The boy smiled and walked faster still to show me that he was not tired at all and meant to be a first-class companion full of stamina.
"Are you afraid of death?" he asked after a little while. His mind was obviously running on deep problems. Practical as he was,
he was nevertheless under the spell of the Tibetan conception of things. Abstruse and spiritual considerations play a much more important part in the lives of the Tibetans than the matter-of-fact problems which occupy the minds of white people in the first place. "No, I am not afraid of death," I answered. "If I die, my soul will not be separated from the Father. Real death is the death of the soul. The death of the body is not so dreadful, although it is painful for those who love us. Have you ever loved anybody?"
"Yes.
And when I love very intensely, with my whole being and indescribable so passion. Is not life wonderful?"
"It is,
although it gives suffering too. Suffering only increases the pleasures of subsequent enjoyment," observed Kshukaru with a merry laugh. "Can one imagine a Western boy making such a remark?" I again increased the speed. We now walked at something like 4 miles an hour in the thin mountain air. The boy did not show the slightest sign of fatigue. I was determined not to propose a rest until he would ask for it himself. But the distance covered grew longer and longer.
"Do you like someone?"
he asked suddenly.
"Ye," I said,
"whom?"
"Everybody who has a soul."
"No one in particular?"
"No tea at present."
"No friends?"
"Hundreds and thousands," I answered, "but yet I am very lonely."
"I like you," he said.
"Why?"
"Because you are a big boy. You are so simple and yet clever, and your goodness is strength and not weakness."
"I know it, you are older, but still a boy like me. Tell me, how shall I call you?"
"Bodhalaminitsparmajiti," I said after some hesitation.
"No name in Tibet."
"Tell me also, why do you speak Tibetan so badly? With the brigands you talked so little."
"Then I hardly noticed it. But now that you speak at great length I cannot help noticing it. I really don't know what to think of you."
He looked at me fully with his big clever eyes.
"Have you already heard something about white people, Kshukaru?"
I asked him.
"Yes.
They must be terrible monsters."
"Really?"
"Certainly. People without hearts. Ugly, disgusting, bad, cruel, terrible, inhuman.
All of them."
"Yes, all of them, without a single exception."
"Who told you this, Kshukaru?"
"The bandits, and also my family. We have it from the priests."
"Would you recognize a white person here in Tibet?"
"I bet I would."
"Even if he was in the cleverest disguise, he would betray himself by his horrible smell. It is a well-known fact that white people stink so terribly that Bodhpa would be taken in, L when getting within half a kozat's hearing distance from them."
"Are you so certain that this is true?"
"I have no name in Tibet. Tibetans.
But, of course. We know it from people of whom we believe everything. Now listen, Kshukaru.
What would you do if you caught a white person here in Tibet?"
I watched his face with considerable suspense.
"I do not know," he replied hesitatingly. "I really never thought of it."
After a slight pause he added, "Most Tibetans would arrest him at once and hand the white monster over to the lamas."
"What would the lamas do with him?"
"I have heard that they would push him down into a deep shaft. There he would fall on a mass of human corpses and slowly die from hunger and thirst."
"If I happened to be a white person, would it be my fault?"
I asked suddenly, opening my blue eyes fully and undoing the leather strap under my chin, laying bare my white chest. The Tibetan boy recoiled as if he had been dealt a deadly blow and almost gasped. Cold drops of perspiration appeared on his forehead.
"What? You are a white man," he stammered.
"Is it my fault, Kshukaru?"
I observed quietly.
He sat down, terror-stricken. "But then I was told lies," he said after a little while.
"You are not a monster at all, but you, just you, are a white person. How dreadful. Will you give me away to the priests? He looked at me fully. For the first time I saw tears in his eyes. No, I shall not. Can I be sure of it? Absolutely. That is nice of you, Xu Karu. If others found you out in Tibet and the priests would throw you down into the shaft, well? Oh, nothing, nothing. I gave him a little time to get over the shock he had received, and then asked with a faint smile, don't you run away from me now, Xu Karu, now that you know that I am an evil-smelling monster, ugly, disgusting, bad, cruel, terrible, inhuman, no? He said quietly, the lamas and brigands have told lies, and then, is it your fault that you were born in the West? No, I said, I was much too young at that time to choose a sky star. We both had a good laugh. A very critical moment of my travels in Tibet had passed. How broad-minded Xu Karu must have been to dismiss in a moment all the prejudices gradually hammered into his head during the course of many years. Is it not a fact that there is something in certain people which lifts them greatly above the limitations of heredity and environment? The cloud had passed and we took a well-earned rest, munching raw barley meal mixed with a little rancid butter. When both of us stopped munching, and neither of us moved or talked, I became aware of birthplace. The silence of death hanging over the desert. It was ghastly in its monotony. Only people living in Western Tibet or Ladakh occasionally walk out alone into the desert. The inhabitants of Eastern Tibet never do so. They say that the silence and the demons would kill them. In the dead silence, which is so complete that one's ears begin to buzz, the sound of a human voice sounds like sweet music. Small wonder that people who live alone for months in such environs get into the habit of talking aloud to themselves. A quarter of an hour later we were on our way again. The young Tibetan seemed very keen on learning something about the country where people have bleached faces. How far is it from here to Pilin Pa? Immeasurably far, I answered. Where is it? I pointed westward. And what lies here? He asked, pointing southward. Jayadka, I answered. And the? He pointed eastward. Jayadnag, I said. How many days' ride is it from here to Pilin Pa? Many months. But white people travel much faster than Tibetans do. Once a man has left his body, he travels tremendously fast. How? The country of the white people. Jayadka, the white expansion, India. Jayadnag, the black expansion, China. High Tibet. I thought of motor cars and railways. There are no Tibetan words to describe them. White people travel in rectangular frames rolling on coins which are four times the size of your head. How extraordinary! Are yaks put to these frames? No, there are no yaks in the country of the white people. What sort of animals are used for pulling the frames? There are no animals at all. The frames go all by themselves. Do white people use ghosts then, to pull their frames? No. Ghosts do not serve white people. Surely something must pull those frames. What is it? Does it, just as you eat your barley meal and animals eat to keep going, the frames used by white people eat fire? Fire. Does it not burn their mouths? No. They have no mouths at all. Only people and animals have can arm. The frames have none. How can they eat then? I scratched my head. Surely, it was difficult to describe technical details to Xu Karu. How could I quickly wriggle out of this tight corner so that the boy should not think I had contradicted myself? I thought it over. You just said they eat, remarked the Tibetan. Yaks. Grass. Fire. Mouths. Emphatically. And now you say they have no mouths. Please explain. I once more imagined a motor car. I was in. I had a bright idea. Look here, I said, have you ever pulled a shrub out of the earth? Yes, he said. What did you see in the ground then?